listening to Paddy Pigskin with Gary Somerville.
Hello, Pigskin Nation. This is your host, Gary Somerville, and this is episode 7 of Paddy Pigskin. And 7 is a fairly important number for me. I was born on the 7th, and it should be a national holiday in Ireland, but it isn't. But whatever. So I felt like I had to put on a cracker of an episode, and a cracker of an episode is what we have. I have an amazing guest, a really fantastic guest, actually, pretty famous as well on today's show. That woman is Aisling Daly, a.k.a. Ash the Bash, former UFC fighter and teammate of some young fella from Dublin called Conor McGregor. I've never heard of him myself, but apparently he's a big deal. And, you know, we like to have the banter and a bit of fun on Paddy Pigskin, but we also like to tackle, you know, serious issues. And this episode is tackling one of those issues. Ash came on the show to talk to me about CTE and concussions. So me being a football guy and CTE and concussions well documented in the NFL, I've had the odd concussion myself. And Ash, being a former combat sports competitor, she actually retired due to a brain abnormality herself. So I felt like she was a really good candidate to come on the show and chat about CTE and concussions across both our sports, and, you know, chat a little bit about how improvements can be made to both sports to make sure that young kids that are taking up these sports, you know, further down the line won't have any of these problems that are documented over the last few years. So, and thanks be to Jesus, two good players, well, on my list anyway, have worn the number 7 jersey. The first of my most famous players to wear the number 7 jersey in the NFL is John Elway. And John Elway is the current GM of the Denver Broncos in the AFC. And this was actually the team that drafted him in 1983 with the first pick of the draft. And they drafted him out of Stanford. So he played his entire 16-year professional career with the Broncos. And when he retired in 99, he had recorded the most victories by a starting quarterback, and statistically was the second most prolific passer in NFL history. He was also a prolific rusher of the ball. He was one of only two players to ever score a rushing touchdown in 4 different Super Bowls, would you believe? The other being Thurman Thomas, and the only quarterback to do so. So when you look at his career highlights and awards, I mean, where do I start? It's a pretty long list. He was a very, very successful quarterback. He won 2 Super Bowls, and he was the MVP in one of these. He was the MVP of the 1987 season. He's gone to 9 Pro Bowls. He was the NFL Man of the Year in 92. He has his number 7 jersey retired at the Denver Broncos, and he's also in their Ring of Fame. He's a Hall of Famer, and he also had his number 7 jersey retired at Stanford. So, pretty successful. His stats, again, very impressive. He has 300 touchdowns to 226 interceptions, over 50,000 passing yards, over 3,000 rushing yards, and 33 rushing touchdowns. So, very successful quarterback. My second most famous number 7 jersey wearing player is actually a current player, and that's Ben Roethlisberger of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And like John Elway, he was also a first round draft pick. He was drafted in 2004 out of Miami of Ohio by the Pittsburgh Steelers. And similar to Elway, he's also won 2 Super Bowls as a player. He's been to 5 Pro Bowls in 2007, 2011, and 2014 to 2016. He was the NFL passing yards co-leader in 2014. He won Rookie of the Year in 2014. And, I mean, if he keeps on the pace he's going, he'll probably end up in the Hall of Fame alongside John Elway. And he has one of my most memorable touchdown passes in a Super Bowl. And that was the one to Santonio Holmes with 35 seconds left against the Arizona Cardinals in Super Bowl 43 when they won 27-23. So, yeah, another famous number 7 jersey wearing player. So, luckily, on number 7 today, my parents got 2 good players, because in the last episode, it was episode 6, and we had 2 kind of shy players. So, so this episode is dedicated to John Elway, current GM of the Denver Broncos, and Big Ben Roethlisberger, who has actually been to Ireland once or twice when Mr. Rooney was the US ambassador to Ireland. So, this is episode 7, and this is dedicated to these two fantastic quarterbacks. So without further ado, let's get on to today's guest. So my first guest on today's episode of Paddy Pigskin is Aisling Daly, a.k.a. Ash the Bash. Ash, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So for anybody that doesn't know who Aisling is, a lot of my listeners are American football fans. Aisling is easily the most famous and successful athlete I've had on the podcast so far. She is a former MMA fighter and she has a record of 16-6 as both a flyweight and strawweight. She was Ireland's first ever pro female MMA fighter and she's also Ireland's first ever female Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. She fought in a host of different organisations, so she fought in Cage Rage, Invicta, Bellator and also of course the UFC. She was a contestant on the Ultimate Fighter TV show. She finished her career in the UFC with a record of 2-1, including a great win in her hometown in Dublin of 2015. And as well as the win, I think the fight was really memorable for her walkout. I think it was voted one of the best walkouts of all time in the UFC when she came out to Zombie by the Cranberries. And I remember watching on TV and the hairs on the back of my neck were sticking up. And, you know, the atmosphere in the O2 arena that night was incredible. So, yeah, she's definitely remembered very fondly in UFC and MMA circles. So, unfortunately, Ash retired earlier this year due to an abnormality in a brain scan. So, as this show is going to be chatting a little bit about CTE and brain injury and mainly the NFL, but also other sports, I thought she'd be a great candidate to come on and talk about her own experience. So, again, Ash, thanks very much for coming on. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your decision that made you retire from MMA there that you had to make this year?
Well, basically earlier on this year, just a routine brain scan. You know, once a year we have our annual medical and we get our brain scan done. And my doctor called me into the office and said, look, there's something showing up here that I'd like to get checked again. So I went for another couple of scans, various different gradients and whatever, just to make sure that what we were seeing was what we were seeing.
Yeah.
And it turned out that there was just a little bit of evidence there that I'd had a brain hemorrhage at some point in the last year. Just a small hemorrhage, tiny hemorrhage. I didn't notice any side effects at all in my day-to-day life. You know, I can kind of pinpoint it down to maybe 1 week where I felt a little bit off. You know, I kept telling my friends I just felt a bit unsteady or a wibbly-wobbly wonder, as I was calling myself. And I think maybe it was that week, but basically, just the way it works with it, with something like that, is there's a little bit of scar tissue or your brain doesn't quite heal exactly the way it was before, so it just leaves you open to a little bit more risk in that area. So I was at a great point in my career, you know, I still had my personality, my health, everything.
Yeah.
So my doctor just said, look, in my expert opinion, I think that you should retire. I think you should quit while you're ahead, you know.
Mm.
The way it works with a hemorrhage or any kind of brain injury is that effectively that area that's damaged will die off, and whatever that's responsible for, you lose that. So if it was something that was really important, you could lose the use of a limb, you could not be able to speak properly or something like that. And, you know, even just parts of your personality change, which is obviously a big thing with CTE. And that scared me. You couldn't pay me any amount of money to lose parts of myself. And
absolutely,
I just decided that was the best decision for me. You know, I'd done a lot in the sport. I hadn't achieved everything that I wanted to achieve. But to finish the way I finished on such a high in Dublin, my home crowd, and to have such an amazing walkout and such a great performance on the night, you know, I don't think it would ever be topped, even with a UFC title, because that would be Vegas. It wouldn't be at home. And I'd love it, but it wouldn't be the same. So I agreed with the doctor and I just said, yeah, I'll quit while I'm ahead. He said I was allowed to compete in grappling still, and that was originally my base, my first love. So I had to just make peace with that.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned there, you know, your last fight in the UFC was in Dublin, and like there's very, very few fighters get to say that they went out, you know, with a win on their home turf. So yeah, you didn't get to prolong your career in the UFC, but like you said, that was an amazing night. Like, people talk about that all the time, about, you know, you remember that night when Aisling walked out to that song in Dublin. Like, to go out on that kind of note was pretty amazing. So you went out on, you know, not perfect terms, but I think you went out on good terms in regards to winning at home. So the reason why I have someone like Ash on the show is because a few weeks ago, Hall of Famer and football player Warren Sapp, he announced he was going to donate his brain to the Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Study in Boston University. So it's actually just around the corner from where I work. And this issue has been raised, it's raised its head among many famous players over the last few years, including one of the major ones was Hall of Famer Junior Seau. He was a linebacker. He sadly shot himself, and he actually shot himself in the chest so his brain would be preserved to be donated to the CTE study. And also Aaron Hernandez. So Aaron Hernandez, former Patriots player, he had his brain donated to Boston University as well. So a big deal over in the US. He actually hung himself after serving time in a Massachusetts jail for a murder. He had just gotten off a double homicide, and you know, some people out there are saying that maybe the effects of all the hits in the head kind of led him to, unfortunately, this decision. And another famous one, Mike Webster, he was a four-time Super Bowl winner with the Steelers. He also killed himself, and he was featured in the movie Concussion starring Will Smith. And it was shown that in the autopsy, his brain had significant CTE, and it was shown to be something equivalent of like a 90-year-old Alzheimer's patient. So my own granddad sadly had Alzheimer's, so this was like an issue that was close to my heart, and it really kind of got me interested in the whole thing. So, and Will Smith was the main man in the movie. He played Dr. Bennett O'Malley, who was the man that looks like he's after the one he discovered CTE. So you were actually on a panel discussion there a couple of weeks ago, was it, in Dublin?
Yeah.
And it was hosted by the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland, and Dr. O'Malley himself had come over to Dublin to talk about some of his research. And also some of the other guys on the panel included Bernard Jackman, a former Irish rugby player, and also some representatives of the Football Association of Ireland, the GAA, and also the IRFU, which is the Rugby Association. So, and also Ash, having been involved in combat sports, was invited to be on the panel. So can you tell me a little bit about what you chatted about on the panel, and yeah, just your interaction with the guests and actually getting to meet Dr. O'Malley himself?
Yeah, basically Dr. Bennett spoke for maybe 40, 45 minutes about his experience with the NFL, similar to the storyline and concussion, explained a little bit about how the story came about, explained how he came to be in the United States, and how difficult the NFL made his life initially starting off because they were trying to cover up this research which he had discovered.
Yeah.
And still to this day, there seems to be people in denial about the correlation between head injuries or impact to the head and CTE. So Bennett takes a very kind of aggressive stance. He's almost anti anything that involves impact.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't necessarily agree with. There would have been a lot of topics that he would have come up with, you know, like children in sport, and the idea of soccer and stuff where children aren't allowed to head the ball till a certain age. So
yeah, yeah.
I don't agree that there should be no impact ever for anyone. I don't think you can limit everybody to track and field for their entire life, but I definitely do think that adults should be allowed to make the decision for themselves. You know, if you reach 18 years of age, you can decide whether you want to enter a high impact contact sport or whatever. Because obviously in Ireland we don't have anything like American football, the focus was mostly on the rugby side of things. And the rugby guys were really getting a bad rap. They were getting a lot of kind of negative comments and stuff. There's a little bit going on at home at the moment where the Rugby Association don't seem to be quite as open and upfront about the facts and statistics, and you know, the players themselves are worried, and the rugby union don't seem to be kind of acknowledging that players are scared that maybe they are going to end up with CTE in a few years, and certain things maybe aren't in place, like the return to play protocols and stuff like that. That's just getting you well enough to get you back onto the field. That's not really preventing anything. At that point, the damage is already done.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting discussion. You know, with soccer, it tends to be far less impact. And heading the ball doesn't seem to be as prominent a part of the game anymore. The ball is not anywhere as heavy as it used to be in bygone days. But I think the focus was mostly on changing the rule set for children. And then with children and goalposts and just awareness for head clashes and stuff, that was one of the things that Dr. Bennett was focusing on to do with soccer, because children haven't developed fully mentally until about 18, between 18 and 25. If you have 10-year-old children playing, they might not necessarily be heading the ball, and they might not necessarily be supposed to hit into each other, but it happens a lot. They just can't find their own feet and they clash heads.
And, and see it all the time,
Yeah, so that was one of the focus he was on. It was very interesting to meet him, and he's a very, very enthusiastic, charismatic man, almost preacher-like with how he speaks. He seems to be a very caring man. He seems to be a big humanitarian, and that seems to be where his passion and his concern genuinely comes from, a love for like the human race in general, and you know, see your brother and yourself. He's quite religious, so right, it was just interesting to meet him. He was a fantastic character.
Yeah.
And like I said, I did agree with some of the points he made, and other points. I don't think it can become a state where the government is telling everybody what they can play and what they can't play. Yeah. You know, I think adults have to have a choice in the end.
Yeah, and a little bit of back to the fact that rugby is kind of a little slower to acknowledge the whole head trauma. Like, I'd be watching some rugby games, and I guess I have a better eye for these things, having, you know, I had a few concussions myself. I had 3 pretty much in the space of 2 years. One was in a really bad one. Basically caught a ball, got flipped up, and like landed straight on my head. Like, there was actually a photographer that just happened to be there and took, it actually is a pretty good picture, but like, you know, you can see like my neck was under quite a bit of stress. And for months afterwards, I was like, you know, there were some days I had to leave the lab and go home because like the lights were so bright, and I was like, actually my eyes are in bits, and I'd have to go home and lie in a dark room and stuff. And you know, now when I watch these sports, especially like I'd watch rugby, and you know, some, you know, there's a similar skill set between rugby and American football, and you see guys, and like, it's easier to see their eyes because they haven't got a helmet on, first of all. They're getting absolutely crunched, and they're on the ground. A trainer may or may not come over, and they're getting up and they're wobbly, their eyes are glazed over, and it's clear like that the guy is concussed, and he might go to the line for a little bit, and they'll do the old, how many fingers am I holding up, and it's like, ah, he's all right, and he goes back in. Now, a few years ago, a kid up in Northern Ireland died from second impact syndrome, where he got hit, he went to the sideline, it was like, ah, you know, shake it off, went back out, hit in the head again, dead. And it was like, just the lack of, you know, neurological testing on the sideline and stuff like that was sadly the kid's downfall. And now in the NFL, they have a very set concussion protocol. If you get hit in the head, you're on the sideline. They have a league designated neurological expert who's, so he has no affiliation to any team. He's looking at you, he has a load of tests. If it's deemed you have any sign of head trauma, you're shut down. So one, you're not going back into the game, but two, then you're on a concussion protocol all week. So basically, they're examining you all week. If you're not showing any signs of progression, you're out for the next game. Until you show any signs of improvement, you're pretty much like shut down. So that doesn't seem to be happening in rugby. So in your area of expertise, being a former MMA fighter, you seem to be getting involved in like safe MMA. So are things improving in MMA? You know, there was the well-documented passing of, I believe, Carvalho was the second name.
Yeah.
Where he fought, it was actually an SBG teammate, yours, Charlie Ward, was it? And, you know, it sent shockwaves around the world where he got stopped in the fight. He actually got knocked out, did he? And then half an hour after the fight, backstage, he was feeling unwell, ended up in the hospital and sadly passed away. So that seemed to be a bit of a kick up the arse maybe for the MMA world. So has much changed, many improvements since that incident?
Definitely, there's been tons of changes in place. That was definitely a big issue, and it was such a tragic and unfortunate incident, just the way things happened. But there was a lot of stuff already wheels in motion before that incident. Safe MMA has been going since 2013 now.
Right.
I set it up initially with my friend, Professor Dan Healy of Beaumont Hospital. He's one of the top neurologists in the country.
Yeah.
Just to get basic safety standards in place, things like blood work for bloodborne diseases, that wasn't happening. You know, there was the potential that you could turn up and compete against somebody who was carrying some disease and maybe you'd contract it.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a low percentage, but still there's a chance.
Sure.
Even just with annual medicals to detect, you know, things like maybe heart issues or eye problems or something like that people shouldn't be medically cleared for. Obviously, cost is always an issue with these things, so we tried to start off implementing things on a smaller scale as possible that would still be effective. So we started off with an annual medical, biannual blood work, and then pre and post fight medicals, and then depending on your post fight medical, that would determine what was the next course of action for you.
Yeah.
But it was always in the pipeline to have MRIs for fighters before they fought. So after that incident, you know, people couldn't argue about cost, because what price can you put on a life?
Absolutely, yeah.
The only problem was with Joe, he's a Portuguese fighter, so it's very hard for us to get him under our jurisdiction. Safe MMA have a passport system, so it's like a green and red light system. So when you have all your medicals in place and everything's as it should be, you'll be green lighted to compete.
Okay.
But that doesn't always happen with foreign fighters. They do require the blood work and they do require the medical, But especially if it's a late notice fight or something like that, they can't always go through our system.
Sure,
now, I think that's changed pretty much. Everybody has to go through the same system. The inquest, the results still haven't been released, but I have a strong feeling that there might have been a pre-existing condition there. So now at the moment, both our amateur fighters and our pro fighters have MRIs before they compete. So for our amateurs, it's just a once-off ever. So before you ever set foot in the ring or set foot in the cage, you will have a baseline MRI done that will show if there's any abnormality to start with. And then it'll give us a baseline then for in 2 years' time, if you come back and have another scan, we'll be able to see if there's any changes. It's a little bit more for our professionals. So our professionals, it's once a year, and it's an MRI and an MRA. So it's MRI of the brain, but it's also an MRA of the major blood vessels in the neck to make sure that there's no abnormalities there. Now, since this has all come in, there's been a few people like myself who have actually been retired. There was a subarachnoid cyst found in a Scottish fighter who came to compete in Ireland, which literally would have been one blow in the wrong place, and he would have died.
Jesus.
And he obviously was training for a professional fight, so he was sparring day in, day out, you know. So he was very, very lucky. That guy has a young family and a wife, so he felt very grateful and very fortunate. Absolutely, that it was discovered. The unfortunate thing with all these scans and everything, it's fantastic for anything that might show up now, but CTE can't really be detected until post-mortem. So the preventative measures, it's kind of down to each individual coach and each individual gym. Fortunately, we have IMA now, the Irish Mixed Martial Arts Association, so there's protocols in place through them. But if the coach implements them is the main thing, you know. It's very hard to control the day-to-day running of a gym, so we are putting in each individual coach's hands to monitor their own fighters, and if there's something like a flash knockout in training, you know, they have to be the ones to tell their fighter not to train, take some rest, and send them forward to see a specialist then. And we are very fortunate in that Professor Healy does a lot of work pro bono for all the MMA guys. He's a massive boxing fan. A little bit less of an MMA fan, but he likes the people, you know, so we're well looked after. But that obviously can't keep going forward, you know, as the sport grows and participants grow and stuff like that. Professor Healy isn't going to be able to look after every single competitor in the country, you know.
Why is he not an MMA fan? Just
I think he thinks there's more kind of skill in boxing or something like that. Right. He's just a bit old school.
So he doesn't think, like, you know, some people that don't understand the sport of MMA looking at it, and it's like, oh Jesus, that's barbaric, you know, he's lying on him and he's baiting him and it's in a cage. But,
he doesn't think it's barbaric. He just has no interest in grappling, I think.
Oh, fair enough,
If you don't understand grappling, it can look a little bit kind of boring to watch, or, you know, like, there's not much going on.
So you wouldn't be watching you grappling people in the would you?
He actually did. He came along to the show.
Oh, did he? Yeah.
Yeah, but I think he's a fan of me. I think he'd kind of support me if I was, you know, flicking coins off a bridge or something.
So Ash actually won by armbar the other night, which is that's kind of your signature move, really.
Yeah,
I remember, I believe it was in 2007, and I had just come home from a J1. I was off a flight from New York, and my old man says, Gary, do you want to go see an MMA event? It's in the National Arena in South Circular Road.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, Grant, I'd be well up for it. And went there, and Ash, you had the pink hair going on at the time, I think, which was that was your thing at the time. And it was either your second or third pro fight, and you won by an armbar in like 2 minutes or something like that. And I was like, this chick is a badass. She just like submitted this other girl in 2 or 3 minutes. And also Gunnar Nelson was on that card as well. Yeah. So, yeah, you're around the sport a long time. You've definitely seen it all. So it's good to see that there are improvements going on. So as well as the kind of the peripheral improvements, you know, like the scans and the checking the fighter safety and stuff like that. In the NFL, like, once they kind of admitted after all this research that, there does seem to be a link between concussions or brain trauma, whatever you want to call it, and CTE, seem to kick into gear, you know, improvements on the actual game itself. So one that I mentioned earlier on, the concussion protocol, if a guy gets hit in the head, you know, he's getting checked out. They're also improving helmet safety. So, you know, a lot of the helmets now, they're not really concussion proof. You still get hit in the head, you'll get a concussion. So they're trying to, improve the helmets, but also some people are suggesting removing helmets from the game, because in the NFL, these guys are almost using their head as a weapon, because they have a helmet on it. They're kind of leading with the head. So some people are saying, well, maybe if you remove the helmets, will guys stop, you know, actually using their head as a way of stopping people. And also the kids coaching now, they're trying to introduce just better coaching at grassroots level. The coaches are kind of teaching new techniques, kind of heads up football. So again, they're not leading with the head and stuff. So They're the improvements that are being made in American football, the on-the-field improvements. In your opinion, is there any way you can kind of improve just, you know, MMA, like in the cage, in the ring, you know, whatever format there is? Is there any ways you can actually improve the sport, you know, when that bell goes and there's two people in the cage across from each other?
I think it's more to do with accumulation of impact. So I think before you even get to your Saturday night show where you're fighting in a ring or a cage, it's things like your training methods. And this is something that we've definitely done over the last 10 years. Like the difference between the intensity of how we used to spar and the frequency of how we used to spar in the gym has changed massively over the last 10 years. You know, now it's gotten to the point where people don't really spar hard in the gym. We try to focus on light striking and then focus on 100% wrestling and 100% grappling.
Gotcha.
And coming up to a fight, you know, you do kind of need those tough sparring days. You do need days where somebody's kind of going at you and trying to put the pressure on you and stuff like that, because that lets you know if you're able for the physical intensity of a fight.
Sure.
You know, if everything is going to be light and easy in training and then on fight night it turns up and somebody's actually trying to beat you up, it can be frightening, or
absolutely,
it completely throw you off your game. But we try and limit that to the last maybe 2 or 3 weeks out before.
I've noticed in SBG you seem to be you know, a lot of flow sparring.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, initiating the art of the strike, but then, you know, not actually striking with the full intensity. So
that's definitely what we're doing, and that's kind of seems to be a trend that SPG started that has kind of taken on the rest of the country. I think it's just the accumulation of impact. If you're thinking about yourself the way we used to spar, say we'd spar 3 times a week, and 3 times a week we spar 10 rounds, you know what I mean? That's a lot of head trauma to be taken. And then you make that over a couple of years, and how often you're being hit, it ends up being most likely that the damage is going to be done in training and sparring before you even get to the fight. You know, some fights end after 2 minutes without hardly any punches being thrown or landed or anything like that. So I think that's the main thing for MMA, is just that people understand better that you don't need to be sparring very intensely and very hard multiple times a week to be a good fighter.
Yeah.
That idea of flow sparring is the way forward for people who want to train. You know, you only have one brain, and good coaches will keep an eye on their fighters. You know, even myself over in Swords, you know, Chris Fields is the head coach over there for our mixed martial arts. But sometimes I'm around, and, you know, maybe this guy's just there at the end of the mat and I can see them, and I'm like, guys, tone it down, you know, you only have one brain, there's no need to be hitting each other like that. And then you can kind of see them ease off each other. She's right, like, there's no point in us beating each other up on the mats here. And
I'm not going to argue with Ash the Bash, in fairness. This woman knows our shit, like, we're not going to argue. And by the way, Chris Fields has, like, I think one of my favourite, like, nicknames of all time, the Housewife's Choice. I think that's absolutely fantastic. How did he, like, I've actually never known how he came, like, how did that even come about? Or just the Housewives are mad for him? Or
Housewives are mad for him, Chris is a tall, good looking guy. He's 6'4", so everybody's mom loves Chris. If your mom meets Chris, he's a fine fella, isn't he? You know, this kind of thing. So
I'll never have him over to meet my L. Fran might be getting a bit jealous.
If you don't want your mom getting stolen, don't worry around Chris.
So if you were in charge of, like, calling the shots, like, moving forward for, you know, fighter safety in your sport, like, what would you like, if somebody asked you today, Ash, like, these are the things you're, like, you can make these decisions tomorrow, what would you like to see introduced in your eyes that will, like, really kind of clean up the safety aspect of the sport?
I think back again to just coaching. There's so many gyms in the country that have coaches who aren't fit to be coaching. You know, anybody can walk in, it seems, any one day with a very limited skill set or very limited qualifications and set up an MMA gym, you know, because it's the buzzword, you know, it's the hype thing at the minute, you know.
Definitely,
there's some guy, and maybe he done karate for 10 years and watched a couple of Gracie videos online or something, and he's setting up an MMA club, and he doesn't understand the sport. And not only does he not understand the sport, he doesn't understand the safety ramifications of not being an educated coach. So the first thing I do is make a coaching certificate and make sure that anybody who wants to be an MMA coach has to have completed this certain evaluation to say that you are capable. And a large focus, it would be a training and sparring and what to look out for in somebody who might be concussed or have some kind of brain trauma, how to prevent that, you know, what way you should set up your fight team practices or sparring sessions so that these things don't happen in the first place. You know, accidents can happen anytime, you know. I've had even incidents in the gym myself back, you know, many years ago where maybe somebody is trying to throw up a light kick, but at the same time as they throw the light kick, I drop for a takedown. So what should have been a light kick ends up me being kneed in the head.
Yeah.
Because it was just a freak act. Yeah, exactly. Just mistiming of a movement, you know, stuff like that happens all the time, and that's nobody's fault. But to have a coach who's uneducated, setting guys up to spar and spar hard, and almost having these like gym fights or gym wars like that, I think that'd be a huge thing to if everybody is on the same page about coaching and everybody has a similar skill set for coaching and basic safety knowledge. You know, guys have to have first aid to coach. You know, why don't they have to have an understanding of how the sport works or how to spar smart or things like that? So that'd be where I'd start, and then obviously all the other safety things on top of it, making sure that everybody in the country who wants to compete has to have these certain levels of medical and blood work and all that kind of stuff. You know, the medical is very important because all different things can be detected in the medical. You know, sudden adult death syndrome is a massive thing, whereas, you know, an EKG can show up an irregular heartbeat, and you know, it can be worked from there, and these are all things that are tested for in the medicals that, you know, people shouldn't really just be going around day to day and not know what the state of their health is.
You
have to look after yourself to a certain point.
Great. Well, hopefully a lot of those measures are going to be introduced over the next few years. The fighter safety will be paramount. Just in relation to, like, in football, you know, all these guys that, you know, these Hall of Famers, now that the CTE word is the buzzword, a lot of these guys are coming out now and saying, you know, back in my day, like 20 years ago, we were like smacking each other in the head, like all day, every day for, like, you know, the whole summer in the pre-season warm-ups and stuff, or the warm-up to the actual season, so our training camp. And, you know, now that the sports science has evolved, you know, some of these drills that they were doing back in the day, one of them is called an Oklahoma drill, where basically it's almost just like a head-on collision, like something you'd see in a car accident almost. And this was like a daily occurrence for these guys, just smacking each other in the head all day, every day, like two bulls just going at it. And now a lot of them are saying, you know, that those kind of drills need to be just taken away from the game, because some of these drills be done by kids, you know. It was the same sport, so it was like, right, let's get these kids doing the Oklahoma drill, and just, it was madness. And now, like, all these results are coming out, I think the NFL are really being forced into, you know, just changing the way the game is coached and the way the games are played and all that kind of stuff. So hopefully both our respective sports start to evolve a little bit more, and, you know, these long-term negative health effects are minimized by introducing player safety and just positive changes to the game. Roy, well, I have one more question for you. I know this is technically a football podcast, and we've been speaking about safety in both MMA and football. And the major storyline in sports probably in 2017, you probably know what I'm going to ask you here, and that's Conor McGregor against Floyd Mayweather. Who's your prediction?
Obviously, I have to go with my man Conor, you know. But I know, but there's a lot of kind of speculation about it, and a lot of people thinking that Conor shouldn't be in there with him. But Conor is a phenomenal athlete, and if experience has shown us anything, is that you definitely can't doubt Conor, and he has such incredible self-belief, and he's so self-motivated. You know, his mind is his most important phenomenal tool,
really,
along
is,
with that left hand. And, you know, there's a substantial size difference, age difference. You know, Conor's at his prime now. You know, he's peaking, and Mayweather obviously a little bit older, going to be a little bit slower, a little bit smaller. You know, I couldn't doubt Conor, not with that left hand. You know, it just takes one shot. If
That's
any of Conor's fights, you know, we've watched, you know, he hurts people with that left hand.
He does,
all that has to do is land once, like, you know, over whatever 10, 12 rounds, Conor just has to land that shot once. And we all know Mayweather is more kind of counter-punching style, defensive, you know. So,
And just the movements of Conor as well, like, you know, he hasn't got an orthodox way of moving.
No.
I think we see this in the octagon, you know, he catches guys from weird angles and stuff like that. You reckon that might be a little bit of a handful for Mayweather's kind of used to these guys coming, you know, straight on with a boxer stance, and all of a sudden Conor comes in and he's showing this something different, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Everything that Conor has to offer is going to present problems for Mayweather. Conor is an individual, he's a unique animal. You know, even the range that, like, Conor's reach is phenomenal, you know what I mean, for a guy of that height. Like I said, the power in that left hand, his movement is completely unorthodox. And knowing Connor, Connor's working on everything, you know. Connor has a very obsessive personality, so no doubt he's been studying videos of Mayweather for the last month. He's been working with his coach Owen Roddy on ways to beat him, and I'm sure Connor has a lot of tricks up his sleeve, and I really look forward to seeing the fight. You know, I really just hope it goes ahead. I hope I know Connor is very, very excited for this fight, and he's really been working hard to make this happen. And I know Mayweather was dragging his heels in the background, so my only fear in the background is that Mayweather might suddenly get called thief, because I know Connor is very, very up for this and very excited for it, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it. But I'd never bet against Connor, you know.
Fair enough.
I learned my lesson before, you know Connor said he would do something, be like, oh, Connor's crazy, Matt L. Connor from Crumlin,
and then he goes and
does it better than he expects him to do it as well.
So if I asked you to go around to the bookies with me now in a minute, what would your bet be? If you're filling out that slip, what would you write on it?
I'd stick an L10er on him.
L10er on by KO?
Yeah, KO, okay, yeah, for enough. Sure, yeah.
All right, well, there you have it. If you have money and you want to bet on Connor, you got to stick a tenner on it, KO, because Ash DeBarsh says so. Ash, thanks very much for coming on the show, rather. It's been a pleasure. Really good insight onto the world of MMA, and you know, a really important and serious issue that translates to, you know, as well as American football, lots of different sports. So appreciate your vast array of knowledge that you brought to the show. So thanks very much
for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of Paddy Pigskin. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did and you found it informative. I found it very informative. And also, if you win a few quid on the Mayweather-McGregor fight, you probably should buy me and Ash DeBarsh a point out your winnings. So if you're not following me on all the different social media platforms, you can check me out on Facebook and you can like and follow me there. Just search for Paddy Pigskin. Also, if you're on Twitter, you can find me there and tweet away. Just search for @PaddyPigskin. Also, if you're not subscribed to the podcast on iTunes yet, just go into iTunes Store and search for Paddy Pigskin and hit subscribe so you can get all the new episodes as they drop. And feel free to leave a review. I love reading the feedback that I get from people. So if you're enjoying the show, wherever that may be, on your commute to or from work, or even if you're just sitting in your sitting room with a glass of whiskey listening, I'd love to hear from you. So feel free to leave a review on the iTunes Store. So again, that's it for this week. Tune in next time where, as always, we will have less slant and more slantcha. Take care.